Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C, this is Agriculture Today.
It tightens up the U.S. balance sheet quite a bit, tightens up those supplies. So with those much tighter supplies, we expect to see both higher prices and more use. So we lowered our export forecast by 2 million bales, currently now at 12 million bales. It also reduced a domestic meal use estimate and ending stocks down as well.
Mark Jackanowski is the chair of the World Ag Outlook Board looking at the U.S. cotton balance sheet.
And if realized, the current level of ending stocks would be the lowest since 1924. So considerably tighter supply situation for cotton than we had expected as recently as a month ago. And with that, we raised our season average price forecast by 2 cents a pound, currently at 97 cents per pound. That would be up 5 cents a pound year over year.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
Looking beyond 2022, we understand that higher level blends are an important way to expand ethanol use in the transportation sector. That's why EPA is actively engaging with several Midwest governors who have requested that the agency take action to allow year-round E15 sales on a permanent basis using a different mechanism from the Emergency Fuel Waiver Authority.
Rod Snyder is Senior Advisor for Agriculture at the Environmental Protection Agency.
The Clean Air Act includes a provision to address parity between E15 and E10 with respect to volatility on a state-by-state basis. The governor of a state may request the current 1 PSI volatility waiver be removed from certain gasoline ethanol blends in that state, and the EPA should grant the request when certain conditions are met, thus enabling year-round sale of E15. We have now received formal petitions from the governors of Nebraska, Iowa, South Dakota, North Dakota, Minnesota, Wisconsin, Illinois, and Ohio, and we are taking steps to promulgate a rule as quickly as possible. Our intent remains to finalize this action in time for the 2023 summer driving season.
Speaking at a recent convention for the American Coalition for Ethanol, Snyder said farmers have the solution.
All of these activities are happening during a time when the Biden administration has made climate change a key policy priority. And it's really encouraging to see the discussion here this morning, the panel just before, really with the focus around how the renewable fuel sector and ethanol can be part of the climate solution. As someone who's been working on these climate issues now for quite a long time, I took a delegation of farmers to the UN Climate Summit in Copenhagen back in 2009, and I felt like people looked at me like I had three heads. Why are we taking farmers to a UN Climate Summit? And I have felt for a very long time that the ag sector is really uniquely positioned to help deliver climate solutions, one of the only segments of the economy that can actually act as a carbon sink. And clearly, the ag commodities that are the feedstocks for renewable fuels are a critical piece of that conversation. And so it's great to see within industry events like this that being so front and center. So I do want to state emphatically that as I've spoken with Administrator Regan a lot over the last 10 months, he believes that biofuels and ethanol are an important piece of our strategy to help the U.S. meet our long-term climate goals. And of course, meeting greenhouse gas emission thresholds is a fundamental underpinning of our implementation of the RFS. The agency is aware that the science and practice of producing renewable fuels have come a long way since we finalized the assessment that was the basis of the 2010 RFS rule with respect to greenhouse gases and LCAs. To that end, EPA has initiated work to develop a revised modeling framework that will be applied to analyze the GHG impacts associated with biofuels. The agency hosted a workshop on February 28th and March 1st with our federal partners at USDA and DOE regarding greenhouse gas accounting for renewable fuels. The goal of the workshop was to begin a process to update our life cycle analysis framework for biofuels so we can more accurately assess and model GHG emissions. The workshop was well attended. We're pleased with the amount of valuable information that was presented by a number of experts. We are now moving on to the next step in this process, which is conducting what we are calling a modeling comparison exercise. The model comparison exercise will feature models discussed in the workshop and explore further details about these tools. We expect to share additional information on our work in this particular area in the Federal Register or an upcoming RFS rulemaking in the near future, so please stay tuned on that front. USDA and DOE are key partners in this work, and we consult with their teams regularly as part of the comparison exercise work. We are also actively participating in cross-agency teams looking at LCA topics, for example, also looking at sustainable aviation fuels, which has been discussed this morning.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
The American Farm Bureau Federation distributed a third drought impact survey in June to its members in 15 states across the western U.S. Danny Munch, an economist with Farm Bureau, said the survey was distributed to state staff, county and state leadership, and farmer and rancher members.
The survey included several demographic questions to distinguish state affiliation and had sections on crop-specific factors, livestock factors, and general water access. By the end, we received over 650 responses from those 15 states, and it got a whole bunch of data on operational-level changes that farmers and ranchers were doing to cope with drought.
The major takeaways from the survey show farmers are continuing to battle severe drought conditions.
Respondents expect their farm-related revenue to be down 38% from average because of drought. 74% reported an expected reduction in harvest yields. 66% reported liquidating parts of their herd or livestock herd. And 73% reported reduced surface water deliveries because of drought conditions. Many more farmers were tilling under crops and removing orchards compared to last year. And of those who reduced their herd size last year, half were continuing to liquidate.
He says communicating the impact of drought on agriculture is crucial to the conversation surrounding effective drought mitigation efforts.
A lot of data on drought impacts is often isolated. It's not uniform across the country, or it's just generally difficult to come by. So we at AFBF recognized the gap in data and decided to run our own survey. This is the third time as drought continues to persist. And that data provides useful insights on the operational level hurdle farmers and ranchers face in coping with that drought that's helpful in our communication efforts.
Chad Smith, Washington.
Well, let's turn to trade for a moment. Iowa Senator Chuck Grassley.
Well, if he wants to be irritable and confrontational, he can do some good by letting people know that he's concerned about agriculture and trade deals and the importance of free trade to agriculture. I don't think he would dare have that kind of courage, but if he did have it, he could make a big difference, and even if he didn't change any policy, he would at least know that the interests that he represents are being heard at the highest levels of trade issues.
He's talking about the nominee for U.S. Trade Chief Ag Negotiator, but what could he do specifically?
As long as Ambassador Tai will let him have some leeway, he probably can't negotiate as long as this administration doesn't want to negotiate free trade agreements, but he might be able to make existing trade agreements more favorable from the standpoint of their execution as it relates to agriculture.
So the bottom line, does Grassley support the nomination?
I haven't been briefed by my staff in his answers to questions for the record. But what I heard about him and his background, I think as of now I could vote for him. And I haven't heard any reason why I can't, but I'm going to wait to make a final judgment when I'm briefed by my staff and go through the QFERS.
Of course, when it comes to trade, you have to wonder about China.
China is acting tough, as you would expect them to do. But in the end, they need trade more than we do.
That's Iowa Senator Chuck Grassley, and again, referring to the saber-rattling, if you will, with China over U.S. ties to Taiwan. It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
This is one of the things that has been a surprise, a fortunate surprise, in the sort of the COVID era.
Barry Worsham is president and CEO of Cotton Incorporated.
You know, the consumer spending overall on clothing adjusted for price changes, which means this is consumer spending in volume terms. You know, we saw this big drop during the first couple of months of COVID, and we were thinking, well, we'd be lucky to get back to that trend line within a year or two, when in fact it bounced back very quickly and then exceeded the trend for the last year or so. We've been way over in terms of consumer spending on clothing. I won't go into a lot of detail as to the mechanics of that, but the simple answer is that consumers were not out and about, and they were not spending money on services. they were spending money on tangible goods, and clothing was a big beneficiary of that. So the percentage of the consumer's dollar that went into clothing increased a pretty substantial amount based on sort of compared historical averages. So the overall market in terms of volume went up dramatically for textiles. We don't have this kind of information on a global basis, but I would assume that some similar things were happening in places like the EU and Japan. So unfortunately, as you can see, that's beginning to tick down. This is not necessarily cotton. This is all textiles. And I think one of the reasons for that is consumers are saying now they're not as concerned about the pandemic as they were before. And now they're going back and spending money in other areas. So we're going to probably see a sort of a short-term reset in terms of overall spending on textiles.
So digging a little deeper into the demand for cotton, let's look at the current demand and market trends.
It really helped the cotton market in the U.S. And this I'm measuring in terms of the retail use for cotton. You know, after we had that sort of pronounced decline, particularly following the price spike in 2010 and 2011, the cotton market has, in terms of a retail side, has kind of come back. It was coming back on a pretty steady basis. It dropped during the early stages of COVID, of course, and now it's actually above the trend line, largely because the overall spending on clothing has been so strong. If you take a bale of cotton and say, where does this come from? A bale of cotton, about 75% now goes into clothing, about a little over maybe 25, 26% goes into home textiles, and the remainder goes into other end uses like wipes and non-woven type applications. So the cotton market, I'm pretty sure this is true globally, is just heavily dependent on the clothing market more than any other by far.
Now, the cotton industry was one of the first to really focus on sustainability, but he says it takes research and development.
We forget sometimes that we talk about sustainability and circularity and some of these other issues, but the bottom line is we still have to grow it effectively, and we have to make products that the consumer is going to want at a competitive price. So continuing to work on innovative and competitive products remains one of the key strategies for helping cotton compete against other fibers. You have to promote it. So consumer and industry promotion remains a high priority for our company. We do also obviously do, it has to be backed up by research, but we have to have promotion dollars to get the word out to consumers in some way, or brands and retailers, or both actually, position cotton as a fiber of choice.
Barry Worsham with Cotton Incorporated. It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
Our last look at peanuts pegging for this year. Virtually all the crop pegging on August 14th, 96% nationally, 1 point ahead of the five-year average, 1 point ahead of last year.
Brad Rippey is a meteorologist with USDA.
Of the eight reporting states, two are fully pegging at this point. That's Georgia, the number one production state, and Virginia. Peanut condition, virtually steady for the week ending August 14th, 70% good to excellent, no change from last week's 70%. That's down a bit from last year's 73% at this time. Meanwhile, very poor to poor ratings at 5% of the peanut crop. That is down a point from last week's 6%, but above last year's 3%. Texas continues to lead the nation in peanuts, rated very poor to poor. The current number there is 13%.
A crop we don't normally talk about, rice.
The rice crop continues to head out quickly, especially in the Mississippi Delta states. 84% of the U.S. rice headed by August 14th, just 2 points behind the five-year average and equal to last year. Meanwhile, rice harvest nationally 11% complete, equal to the five-year average, equal to last year at this time. Rice condition, as harvest gets underway, we are looking at a good crop, generally speaking, 75% good to excellent. That's up a point from last week. 3% very poor to poor, no change from last week. Those numbers very similar to this time a year ago when we saw 74% of the rice good to excellent, 4% very poor to poor.
Definitely a train wreck for the sorghum crop.
Just quickly looking at that sorghum condition, just 27% of the crop rated good to excellent, 38% very poor to poor. That's a fairly sharp decline from last week's numbers, 29% good to excellent, and 35% very poor to poor.
Those very poor-to-poor numbers are pretty much across the board. Only a couple of states, Colorado and South Dakota, have escaped the full ravages of this drought of 2022. And we see really high numbers coming in from our big production states, Kansas 43% very poor-to-poor, and Texas 44%.
And it's hard to believe, but we're still harvesting winter wheat.
90% of U.S. winter wheat harvested by August 14th. That's 4 points behind the five-year average, even further behind last year's 97%. Producers have had to be patient in the Northwest, waiting for this delayed crop to mature. We still have two states, Idaho and Washington, that have not reached the 50% mark on harvest. In fact, Idaho just 28% harvested on August 14th. Five-year average is 69%.
And as we're wrapping up one wheat crop, we're focusing on a spring wheat crop.
Looking at the spring wheat crop, harvest underway now in all six of the spring wheat production states, 16% complete nationally on August 14th, far behind the five-year average of 35%, and even further behind last year's 55%. That said, though, even though it's a late crop, it's a much better looking crop than last year. Spring wheat condition, as we head toward the tail end of the season, 64% good to excellent, 6% very poor to poor. Only minor changes from last week's numbers when we were at 64% good to excellent and 8% very poor to poor.
And corn.
As we look at corn condition for the week ending August 14th, just a slight overall decline in the condition. Looking at the good to excellent rating this week, 57% of the crop in those two categories. A week ago, that number was 58%. A year ago at this time, 62% good to excellent. Meanwhile, no change in the very poor to poor ratings. Steady at 16%, but that is higher than last year's 13% very poor to poor.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
It is not just the U.S. driving a 1.4 million ton month-over-month soybean production increase in the global supply and demand balance sheet.
The other big increase in terms of higher production forecast for this month is China.
USDA World Agricultural Outlook Board Chair Mark Jekinowski says the Chinese bean production increase is a result of higher area. The combined rise in world soybean production contributed primarily to increases across the board in global supply and demand categories.
Total supplies up for the new crop year by 2.4 million tons. Crush forecast we raised by 600,000 tons. Trade increased by 200,000 tons, and that is mainly the U.S. expected to increase more given its larger crop. Ending stocks up, reflecting higher stocks in China, Argentina, and the U.S.
I'm Rod Bain reporting in Washington, D.C.
Well, it ties right into trade. Chad Smith reports.
Indiana farmer Joshua Miller is the new chairman of the U.S. Grains Council's Board of Directors. Miller is a fifth-generation farmer from Anderson, Indiana, and produces corn, soybeans, and wheat primarily as a 100% no-till row crop operation. He talks about why the U.S. Grains Council is important to him.
The Grains Council mission is so important for the U.S. farmer, and it just goes back to simple numbers for me. We've got approximately 94% of the world's population that lives outside of our borders. That population has a growing middle class looking for more proteins, not necessarily more food, but better food. They're looking for higher protein contents in their diet, looking for some more animal protein. And we're in a fortunate place in the United States. Nobody can grow crops like we do. And then with ethanol and the byproduct of dry distillers' grains, we're in a position to literally feed the world and feed that growing population.
Miller talks about his chairman's theme for the upcoming year, which is Live the Mission.
The grain Council mission as a whole is developing markets, enabling trade, and improving lives. And my challenge to the delegate body and my chairman's theme this year is to live the mission. We are coming out of an unprecedented time of pandemic with global trade issues. Fuel and energy costs are on the rise. It's important now that we stay focused to our mission, and it's important now that we remain fervent to our mission as well. So my challenge to the delegate body and the farmers is to live this mission. We want to continue to develop markets, enable trade, and improve lives worldwide, and let's get out there and live that mission and be the forefront of that.
Miller talks about a couple of the biggest things he'd like to accomplish over his year as chair.
Number one is we've worked long and hard, 4+ years as a board, to get a brick and mortar office open in India. India is a growing market, leaps and bounds, and that's someplace we need to have a presence. So we are going to have our ribbon cutting in the India office in January of 23. We are very excited about that. Another one of my real focuses on my chairman year and living the mission is the African market in general. I think that we have a unique opportunity there to be more involved in the continent of Africa and a multitude of countries within that continent, just to make sure we're making our presence known and forging those relationships in a multitude of ways with feed milling and feed rations and poultry production, just to name a few.
When he's not busy with USGC work, he keeps plenty busy at home.
I'm a fifth generation farmer. We farm corn, soybeans, and wheat. And we have a seed dealership and a small crop protection business. And I've got 3 young boys, 2, 5, and 7, that are coming up and just excited to be a part of the operation any chance they get. So it's an ongoing family operation. We're just excited for every day. We're in a great spot.
Again, Indiana farmer Josh Miller, the new chair of the U.S. Grains Council. Chad Smith reporting.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
We know from talking to brands and retailers, there could be potential changes in the sourcing locations of these companies.
That's Barry Worsham, president and CEO of Cotton Incorporated.
They are right now heavily located in Asia, in Hong Kong. But if those tensions continue, and if there continues to be restrictions in terms of travel, will the brands and retailers shift locations to some other place? You know, I don't know. It could be Singapore. It could be Thailand, Bangkok. Who knows? But if that does happen, that'll have an impact on us in terms of how we go about reaching these people and where our people are located.
He also talks about how brands and consumers want to know more.
So, you know, if you're looking at the big picture in terms of a strategic plan of how can cotton, what are some of the key things that we are doing or hope to do to improve or protect cotton's position against other fibers? One is we have to address the transparency traceability issue, meaning that the supply chain now wants to know everything about where the product was made, if it's a natural product. They want to know where it was grown, even who grew it in some cases. They want to know how it was processed, who processed it. Was there any environmental impact? If so, is there any forced labor in there? This is being driven by legislation in the U.S., but it's also been driven by sort of consumers really wanting to know more than they've ever known about products. And this is not just textiles. This is really all products. So there's some way perhaps that we can add value here. We can't solve the whole issue, but we can certainly work with brands and retailers to improve it for cotton. So we don't want, in other words, what we're trying to prevent is if somebody has difficulty knowing where the cotton is coming from, or they can't prove it in terms of bringing product in, that they will switch to other fibers, and we don't want that to happen. Moving down that list, circularity is something that's been on the radar for several years. It's increasing in importance. And what that means is it's one thing to have a product that, quote, is sustainable, it was grown, you know, or processed in the right way, but more and more consumers and brands and retailers are looking for, tell us what happens when that product ends its life. Is it tossed in a landfill? Is it possibly repurposed into something else? We have some things that are beneficial for cotton, which I'll talk about a little later, but we need to ramp that up so that we have a better story that you know, we're not going to take all the cotton that's grown in the world and recycle it into additional, you know, the clothes. And that's just a continuous loop. Every time you chop up a cotton product, you're going to lose fiber length. So there's only so much you can do. But there's other things we can do, like I've seen what looks like to change it into insulation. We've had a program on that for a decade or so. But also we're looking at perhaps taking that cellulose and converting it to sugars and repurposing in other end uses.
And what it's like moving from defense to offense.
We've got to exploit competitive fiber weaknesses. In this one, the primary weakness that we see on the polyester is in the microplastics. Polyester produces little fibers. When the product is washed, it makes its way into streams. It's a plastic. The fish eat the plastic and we eat the fish. And it's gaining in terms of people knowing about it and knowing that polyester may not be such a good thing after all. And we want to exploit that. We're doing some research that shows that cotton has a big advantage in this particular, on this issue.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today,
a new initiative designed to incentivize conservation practices that improve nutrient management. Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack, making the announcement Monday in Michigan, says the initiative will be based within the Natural Resources Conservation Service.
We're going to put $40 million of resources that we have available and target those resources through a regional conservation partnership program effort to increase better nutrient management around the country.
The secretary adds additional resources at the start of the new fiscal year will be combined with the nutrient management investment to boost NRCS programs and their support of producer-based conservation practices.
With additional resources in EQIP, the Environmental Quality Incentives Program, and both the incentives in the contract program, and additional money in the Conservation Stewardship Program, CSP, to be able to allow farmers the ability and the resources to be able to do an even better job of nutrient management.
I'm Rod Bain reporting in Washington, D.C.